This is Intelligence Matters, sponsored by General Atomics Aeronautical Systems, the world leader in unmanned aircraft, proudly enabling global defense forces around the world with persistent, versatile, and actionable intelligence 24/7.
Andy Boyd retired in the fall of 2023 as a senior intelligence officer in CIA's Directorate of Operations, most recently serving as director of CIA's Center for Cybersecurity, CCI. Prior to his role as director of CCI, Andy served as chief of operations in the Counterterrorism Mission Center. Andy is an Arabic speaker and has served throughout the Near East, involved in some of the most consequential counterterrorism operations of the past decade. Andy also was an intelligence officer in the U.S. Air Force. Andy is now a senior advisor at Beacon Global Strategies. He has his own consulting business advising cyber companies working in the national security space and is on the board of directors of several technology companies. I'm Andy McCreadis. This is Intelligence Matters. We'll be right back after a quick break. Gather life-saving intelligence while keeping warfighters out of harm's way. General Atomics Aeronautical Systems, maker of the Predator and Reaper, is the leading designer and manufacturer of cutting-edge unmanned aerial systems and mission solutions. At any hour of any day, their innovative multi-mission aircraft are ready to deliver unmatched actionable intelligence over the world's harshest terrains. Industry-leading endurance, modular designs, and advanced autonomy make General Atomics Aeronautical Systems unmanned aircraft the perfect partner for every role in every domain. Learn more at generalatomics.com. Welcome back. Andy, welcome to the podcast. For our listeners, Andy's career and mine intersected several times, especially in our last few years at CIA. So it's a real pleasure to have you on the podcast, Andy.
Thank you, Andy. I'm really glad to be here.
Okay, so before we talk about sort of broader cyber threats, can we sort of baseline and can you characterize the cyber landscape today and how it's evolved over the last few years?
Yeah, so, I mean, it's interesting. I mean, we've had a number of public discussions where a decade ago, it was really sort of a niche. Cybersecurity was a niche industry for professionals in the cybersecurity industry and people in the intelligence community. Just a month ago, we had a public hearing of General Nakasone, who at the time was still commander of Cyber Command and NSA, Jen Easterly over at CISA, Harry Coker over at the White House Office of the National Cyber Director, really kind of laying out in a very public forum threats from the People's Republic of China, specifically called Vault Typhoon, wherein the Chinese place tools on our critical infrastructure, pre-positioning tools for use in times of conflict. So that's on the China side. On the Russia side, we hear every day about the Russians using their tools for disinformation, especially as we're leading up to the 2024 election cycle. Likewise, we hear of the Iranians using their tools, particularly in the realm of what I call coercive diplomacy. Last year, attacking infrastructure in Albania to coerce the Albanians to give up hosting the Mujahideen al-Haq, an Iranian opposition organization. And then finally, the North Koreans. The North Koreans use their cyber tools a bit differently, but they use it to steal cryptocurrency and sometimes fiat currency from banks with weak security to fund their weapons programs. Because as you know, we have sanctioned the North Koreans, we and our allies, to the point where that's their only fundraising technique. So that's the threat landscape that we're in right now. I think the other change is the engagement from the policy community, the establishment of the Office of the National Cyber Director, the focus on Congress on the cyber threats, and most recently, just a couple of weeks ago, the Cyber Security Safety Review Board, which is hosted by the Department of Homeland Security, but has a number of private sector experts. They wrote a paper faulting Microsoft for not taking care of, not building a culture of security, really kind of building a culture of getting new tools out and selling to their customers, and really kind of highlighting that we've focused over the past decade or so on victims and villains, the villains being the state actors, the victims being you and me, and other Americans, but now really focusing on the vendors and the deep responsibility that Microsoft and other vendors have on securing their products so that it is not a national security threat. And that's where I see us right now in the cyber landscape.
So Andy, you know, I was just in Taiwan and met with Audrey Tang. She's Taiwan's Minister of Digital Affairs. And we had a fascinating discussion about Taiwan's cyber defense strategy. They feel they're under attack all the time, sort of a 24/7 kind of thing. And you just mentioned, you know, the office at the White House, you know, run by Harry Coker. So how do you see the U.S. cyber strategy? Is it a unified thing, or are there just disparate pieces that are all under an umbrella at the White House? Can you just describe to our listeners how that works?
So, you know, I always use the metaphor for the counterterrorism realm. And after 9/11, it took us a couple of years to coalesce as a counterterrorism community. In the beginning, the special operations community was doing one thing, the intel community was doing another, law enforcement was focused on other things. But I think we've advanced quite a bit. And I really credit Harry's predecessor, Chris Inglis, with coming up with a grand strategy on how we as a whole of government and partnering with the private sector counter these threats. The strategy is set up in five pillars. Pillar two and five are the ones that, you know, frankly, in the intel community, we focused most on is, you know, countering the threat, just like we counter terrorism threats. And then pillar five, building international partnerships globally, as we do in CIA and the rest of the intel community, so that we can counter those threats. And so our relationships in Taipei, our relationships in Kyiv, our relationships across the Five Eyes are critical to that strategy. And each one of the agencies that are the cybers, so to speak, be it Cyber Command, be it the intel community, be it FBI cyber, be it DHS, has a different role in all that. The one thing that I don't think we've fixed yet is, you know, we could have folks from the intel community visiting Taipei one day and DHS the next day, and that travel of seniors and engagement with our foreign partners is sometimes not as well coordinated as it could be. But I think we're getting there, and I think we do have the waterfront covered, both from a defensive perspective and analytic perspective, and how we engage the private sector both in the United States but abroad quite well.
Sandy, here in a second, I'm going to just ask you about some of the specific threats that you touched on and that were in the DNI's annual threat testimony. It came out last month.
Yes.
But as you sort of, you know, think about all these challenges that we face, do you think that the U.S. is well positioned? And I guess what I'm asking, you know, from your previous comments is the public-private partnership, you know, between the government and cybersecurity companies, you know, et cetera. How do you see that?
So I, you know, I think the Vault Typhoon discussions are a good example of that. Again, it was a lot of intel community input, but also Microsoft itself, which was the victim on the Vault Typhoon issue, did an enormous amount of research and collaborated with the government to come up with a releasable, unclassified understanding of how that transpired. That being said, you know, 40% of vulnerabilities globally that are exploited by nation state actors and non-nation state actors are actually the fault of Microsoft. So I do think the next stage for the public-private partnerships, and the cyber strategy speaks to this, is the responsibility that vendors like Microsoft have to make their products secure. And as Jen Easterly at DHS CISA refers to it, secure by design. That's a long-term goal that frankly will take years, if not decades, to achieve. But it's a change in philosophy where the government, you know, most of the technology, the software, the infrastructure, frankly, is owned by the private sector. And if the private sector isn't designing their infrastructure, designing their software to be secure by design, we are going to have massive problems in the coming years. Nation state threats, ransomware actors, et cetera, et cetera.
You know, Andy, there was an article a few years back, and I think I've mentioned it before on the podcast, about the divide sometimes between Washington and and Silicon Valley, and, you know, in particular on this topic, you know, sort of cybersecurity, there are people in the Valley who sometimes believe that, you know, Washington talks out of both sides of its mouth, you know, come up with the most secure thing ever, but make sure we have access in case we need it, you know, for a terrorism issue or something like that. Do you see that divide, or do you think that's overplayed?
So, I mean, I think there's two issues on security. It's the encryption issue, apps on your iPhone or in the Android operating system, wherein it's encrypted end to end, and there's some law enforcement folks who you know find that problematic when it relates to counterterrorism, but also counterintelligence and whatnot. But then there's the actual like security flaws in the actual product, be it hardware or software. And I do think, although the U.S. government may not see eye to eye on the end-to-end encryption issues, on the other issues, on building products that are secure by design, where the thoughts on security, privacy, data security, how different devices interact with the cloud, et cetera, et cetera. I do think there is a good public-private partnership on that. And I do think Silicon Valley and other parts of the cyber industry, software and hardware, and infrastructure providers, telecom providers, have been looking for quite some time for some leadership from the U.S. government, both on the executive branch side and on the legislative side. And I think we're finally getting there. I do not think we're going to resolve the philosophical differences on end-to-end encryption. I just think we're going to have to agree to disagree on that. And when FBI needs to have a warrant, they will go to Apple, they will go to the folks that manage the Android OS and just have to get it via court order.
So Andy, you mentioned some of the threats at the top, and last month, the DNI issued its annual threat testimony. And in there, they touch on the same sort of suspects, if you will, as the primary adversaries. They, from what I could tell, they articulate five. And I just want to just step through them maybe in just a little bit more detail. I'll sort of go one by one if
yes,
that's good.
Great.
And I'll give you the tagline that I pulled out of the report for each one. And so the first one, obviously, is China. And the bit of a tagline from the report is the most active and persistent cyber threat actor.
Yes.
So can you talk a little bit about China, and then we'll just step through the others just so the audience can get a sense of the similarities and differences between them?
So, I mean, I think the PRC is the most profound cyber threat that we have. I mean, over the past decade, I mean, they've used their cyber tools differently. Intellectual property theft has been their mainstay. Frankly, they considered intelligence collection. We obviously don't have the authorities to go steal intellectual property across the globe. But everything from our defense industrial base to our healthcare sector, medical devices and whatnot, the intellectual property behind that has been stolen by the PRC so that they can leapfrog into, you know, we spent as a government and private sector, a lot of money on research and development. They're trying to leapfrog ahead of that process. In addition, as I alluded to earlier on the Vault Typhoon issue, they see using their cyber tools as sort of getting ahead of phase zero of any potential conflict with the United States, putting tools down on critical infrastructure so that they can, you know, in Confucian terms, win without fighting. And that is a grave threat. There is a bit of PRC use of their cyber tools in the disinformation space, but frankly, not quite to the degree that the Russians have traditionally used that. Again, you know, we thought the Russians were going to use their cyber tools to better effect and starting in February 2022 with the invasion of Ukraine. Arguably, they took down Viasat temporarily, which was a communications tool utilized by the Ukrainians. But other than that, their offensive cyber attacks against the Ukrainians were mediocre at best.
Andy. Thank you for raising it. I mean, that was the next one on their list. And what they say in their report is poses an enduring global cyber threat. But certainly there was a lot of anticipation at the beginning of the Russia-Ukraine thing that the Russia, especially as we supplied Ukraine with weapons, that the Russians would retaliate, you know, and cyber seemed to be the obvious one to a lot of people. But it's interesting what you just said, that their response in Ukraine has been a bit, you know, mediocre. And certainly we've not yet seen, thankfully, any large scale attacks. Why do you think that is?
So I think there's a multiple variables that fell into that. I mean, you saw the sort of train of armored vehicles in the beginning of the invasion in northern Ukraine. And they didn't plan very well logistically. They didn't plan very well. The Russians didn't plan very well for their invasion. So arguably, the same would extend to their cyber attacks. Offensive cyber, particularly disruptive or destructive cyber attacks, takes an enormous amount of planning, an enormous amount of pre-positioning of tools. And if they didn't plan for their invasion, their actual kinetic invasion, they certainly didn't plan correctly for their cyber attacks. But in addition, the Ukrainians have been building up their cyber defenses since 2014 with the invasion of the Crimea, and have a really good series of partnerships with U.S. Companies securing their networks. That's the second variable. So you got to give the Ukrainians some credit for that. And then thirdly, I do think a lot of the reason that there hadn't been, at least in 2022, more destructive attacks, cyber attacks from the Russia side, is they kind of needed those networks for intelligence collection. So when we make reference to a grave cyber threat from Russia, a lot of it is not in the disruptive space, but it's in the intelligence collection space. SVR, GRU, FSB all have intelligence collection capabilities, and the SVR, you know, again going back several years to the SolarWinds exploit, and their penetrations of State Department networks and other federal government networks, and the other entities within the Russian security services use their penetration of social media networks to sow disinformation. I think that's really the gravest threat from the Russia side in cyberspace.
The DNI report goes on to raise Iran, as you did, and there they say willingness to conduct aggressive cyber operations. So what do you think about that? Is that just a regional focus or a more global focus by Iran?
They're certainly very focused on the Israelis, and there was attacks against water treatment facilities in Pennsylvania and Texas that was by, you know, an Iranian proxy that's tied to the Iranian intelligence services, and the attack was actually against a commercial capability in water treatment and water distribution that was built by an Israeli company. So I think that was the trigger for that attack. But the Iranians are testing out their capabilities now. Was it a catastrophic attack? It was pretty irritating for the people in Pennsylvania and Texas because of their water issues. But the companies recovered quite quickly. Again, they had a very effective attack against Albania, shutting down Albanian networks, for weeks on end. Again, because of the Albanians hosting the Mujahideen al-Halk. So, I mean, they have pretty significant capabilities. But to your earlier point, their focus is really on Israel. And they do focus on us, but in the context of our support to Israel. Could they turn their focus on us? Yes, but their capabilities are such that, you know, I think we'd be able to deal with it quite effectively.
The next country that's mentioned is obviously North Korea. There they say sophisticated and agile espionage, cybercrime, and attack threat.
Yes.
And we know the cybercrime because we've sort of seen that from North Korea.
Yes.
But how about the rest?
So, I mean, you know, they will use their attack tools when certain things, like the Sony attack. I mean, they did a hack and leak campaign against Sony when Sony put out a movie that was critical of the leadership in the DPRK. So they clearly have the capability. They have a remarkable ability to, despite the fact that they're, you know, the hermit kingdom in the DPRK, they have a remarkable ability to train people effectively and have a cyber army, so to speak. But their most important need out of that cyber army is funding the government, funding their weapons program via, again, cryptocurrency thievery and what, to the tune of several billion dollars over the past few years. I mean, you can fund a lot of weapons programs in North Korea with all of that. In a conflict with the United States and with South Korea and our other regional partners, would they use those cyber tools to attack critical infrastructure, particularly in South Korea? Yes, but they're right now that is not their focus. Their focus is again funding their weapons programs and using those tools to that effect, and using their tools to collect intelligence against our presence in South Korea and our South Korean allies.
So the last category is, I guess, not non-state actors. And there, the report says, improving their attacks, extorting funds, disrupting critical services, and exposing data.
Yes, that's really, I think, the ransomware threat. And I the White House, you know, considers the ransomware actors to be a national security threat. You know, there's been a philosophy in some in the government that ransomware is a law enforcement issue. It certainly is, and the best disruptor is frequently our law enforcement tools, but it is a broader national security threat. I mean, most recently, UnitedHealthcare had a ransomware attack against the system that we all use at CVS, name your drugstore, for us to get our various medicines across the country. That entire process was disrupted, and UnitedHealthcare had to pay a ransom, or they didn't have to. They chose to pay a ransom to that actor. I believe, especially as these ransomware attacks continue against our healthcare sector, our schools, and various other critical industries that we have in the United States, that we are going to have to focus a great deal more in the intelligence community and in the offensive cyber community, and frankly, use some of our unique authorities across both DOD and the intel community to counter that threat. Because most of the law enforcement action, the FBI just had an operation disrupting Lockbit, and it was very effective. But Lockbit will reconstitute. We can take down infrastructure. We can freeze their cryptocurrency that they make money off of the ransomware attacks. But ultimately, if we can't arrest them, most of these ransomware actors are in Russia or other countries where law enforcement is not going to get access to them. We're going to just have to continue to apply other tools to that threat.
We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back with Andy Boyd.
Beacon Global Strategies is the premier national security advisory firm. Beacon works side by side with leading companies to help them understand national security policy, geopolitical risk, global technology policy, and federal procurement trends. Beacon's insight gives business leaders the decision advantage. Founded in 2013, Beacon develops and supports the execution of bespoke strategies to mitigate business risk, drive growth, and navigate a complex geopolitical environment. With a bipartisan team and decades of experience, Beacon provides a global perspective to help clients tackle their toughest challenges.
So, Andy, we just sort of went over the landscape and then talked about some of the primary actors, and it all sounds a bit daunting. What do you see over the next couple of years? More of the same? Any kind of changes, significant changes in the landscape? How do you crystal ball this?
So, I mean, I think the advent of, you know, we all became publicly aware of AIML via the ChatGPT, the maturity of that over the past several months. I believe that ransomware actors and other criminal actors are going to use AI tools to create idiomatically correct American English type emails and then have links to tools in them. Previously, you'd get, you know, poorly worded emails in spear phishing attacks, and they were fairly easy to fend off. I also think less sophisticated ransomware actors are also going to use AI tools to build their own exploits. You can write a lot of computer code via ChatGPT and other AI tools. I think that is going to be a threat. But so that it's not all doom and gloom, the defensive community has access to those tools as well. And so I do think the defensive community is going to be able to fend off a lot of those attacks. But it is going to be a constant battle between defenders, folks in the government, our CISOs, so to speak, in the U.S. government, and all of the vendors and folks in the cybersecurity community that we team up with, fighting off all of that. So we talked about public-private partnerships earlier. We're going to have to be in lockstep on that, or else we will have a major incident against critical infrastructure, a major incident on a state actor attacking critical infrastructure if we don't. I do think the advent of AIML tools are going to be a game changer in the cybersecurity world.
So, Andy, I guess it was late last year, a lot of the large language model companies AI companies talk to the White House about putting guide rails, so to speak, my words, but putting guide rails on AI to keep it from being used for bad purposes. Do you think that's possible in this arena, or there's always going to be a workaround?
So I mean, it's quite amazing, frankly, that, you know, within 1 year in 2023, the White House put out a cyber strategy and an implementation plan, and then several months later put out an AI executive order, which was one of the more detailed and technical documents I've ever seen come out of the White House. I think that is a roadmap. And whether or not I'd call it guardrails, I mean, I think it's sort of having a conversation between government and industry on what is acceptable, you know, within the AI realm. I do think the debates over, you know, what, you know, certain companies that were intended to be sort of research arms and then, you know, pivoted towards being more profit oriented AI companies. I do think that debate has not been resolved. And I do think that we do need some legislative action and partnership between the executive branch and Congress on not just executive action rules, but also legislation. But I do think that executive order is the roadmap that we all need to follow to make that happen.
You know, Andy, I still believe that the U.S. is the world leader in innovation. And, you know, will remain such. Do you think that that's enough for us to stay ahead of the threats? Because you describe a sort of a cat and mouse kind of game. And that's always, you know, it's a little bit of a spy versus spy thing, maybe is a better analogy. Do you think we can stay ahead?
I think we can. I mean, I think the innovation and, you know, we focus a great deal on Silicon Valley, but, you know, across the country, our research universities, the sorts of people that we, you know, bring out of our engineering programs across the country, and the rule of law and the ability for people to put investment dollars into projects that matter. I mean, I don't. What the PRC has is they can throw millions of people against a problem set and try to brute force it, but they're just never going to be able to keep up, be it in chip manufacturing, be it in software design, be it in handset design, because as they advance, and again, they have to steal intellectual property in the United States to even, you know, get past the research and development problems that they have. I think we will always be ahead. And that's on the PRC end. I frankly think we're always going to be ahead of our European allies as well, just because we have a different approach to research and development, a different approach to venture capital, a different approach to investment. The one thing that I do worry about is debate about spending money on research and development and just research in general from the federal government side. In the 50s and 60s, we spent as a government, we spent an enormous amount of money on research and development that provided seed money to a variety of industries, the space program. I mean, the internet itself was a DARPA, was originated at DARPA. I do worry that we're underinvesting in that, and other countries are, you know, overinvesting, and I think the PRC in particular is investing a lot of their government dollars in that research. That is the one part that I'm concerned about, because although venture capital can bring a lot of great things to the innovation space, I do think the government needs to actually, you know, write checks as well to keep pace globally.
Yeah, as we said earlier, that partnership is going to be more important as time goes by and as the technology, you know, begins to evolve. You know, you mentioned generative AI, but, you know, you've got probably quantum computing coming down the pike, maybe faster than people think. These things always seem to, you know, to accelerate. I mean, look at ChatGPT thing burst on the scene.
Right.
Like in an instant, it seemed, right? Now, right. I know people had been working on it for a number of years. So I think it just highlights the, you know, what you said earlier about making sure that there's a close tie between government and private sector. In this last part of the discussion, you sort of, you know, you mentioned about talent and the talent in the U.S. through universities and other places. An important segment of our audience are students. So both graduates and undergraduate students. So just let me ask you a couple questions there.
because this is a common theme and a common question among some of our listeners. What type of person does a CIA look for in an operations officer, and maybe particularly in someone who wants to be a cyber operations officer?
So, you know, I would argue, like, people always sort of think, oh, should I be an electrical engineering major? Should I be a computer scientist? Should I speak Arabic? Should I speak Mandarin? I think those are important, you know, talents to have. But ultimately, I think what the Directorate of Operations, at least what they looked for when I got hired, and I would argue that they still look for this, is people who have intellectual curiosity, who want to work in the foreign environment, who want to do big, adventurous, and meaningful things for national security. And then, you know, also folks that are able to be self-critical, understand their limitations, and can be self-reflective and grow within, you know, be it the Directorate of Operations, the Directorate of Analysis, and whatnot. Because, you know, you can fake it to a certain extent, but if you cannot be a good intelligence officer if you're not self-aware and able to be self-critical. I think that's honestly the most important attribute. It's not about who's introverted, who's extroverted, who's the best Mandarin speaker. It's really those sorts of capabilities. 25 years ago when I came on board, I think a lot of people in the DO were sort of pure political scientists, or with, you know, I was an Arabist with a focus in a geographic area. I think today's intelligence officers have that over the course of their career, but they also have to be technologists. You can no longer sort of say, hey, I'm not an engineer, I'm an operations officer. You have to be both, not just necessarily an engineer, but you have to be you have to understand technology. You have to understand how technology is applied to national security, how technology can be a threat, but also a tool in the intelligence business. And that's just for the Director of Operations. You know, within my former organization, the Center for Cyber Intelligence, we had an enormous amount of engineers who were not part of the DO. And I would encourage any of the students listening to this program, if you are an electrical engineer, if you are a computer scientist, if you're in that realm, if you're a cybersecurity professional as well, that you should consider CIA as an employer of choice, because we are a quieter organization than some of the rest of the cyber community, but we play a critical role in intelligence collection using cyber tools, but also in understanding the foreign, both nation state and non-nation state cyber threat. And it's a very exciting place to work.
I agree, having spent right. all that time there as well. Right. Okay, so I'm just going to, here at the end here, I'm just going to put you on the spot. You know, one of the roles of CIA is to try to look around the corner and help inform, you know, policymakers about what's coming. If I had to ask you to look around the corner on cyber and cybersecurity, what are the things that are maybe around the corner that people aren't actually thinking about that we need to start thinking about?
So, I think we've taken with the public testimony on Bolt Typhoon and more recent discussions about disinformation, I think we've taken a peek around the corner. One of my concerns is, you know, we shine a light on one threat, Bolt Typhoon, and there's another critical infrastructure threat that we haven't discovered, and the volume of those threats is going to be so significant that we won't be able to keep up with it, and that's again on the PRC side. On the disinformation side, I do believe we're going to have this sort of slow rumble of disinformation over the next several months en route to our elections. What I'm very worried about is, for instance, 72 hours out from the election, disinformation that is not of a global scale, but is localized in a specific election district, wherein disinformation comes out on a local oriented website that says, hey, the polling place where you guys normally vote, there was a fire there last night, or a flood, there's no voting, sorry, you know, your polling place is shut down. And that sort of disinformation is going to be extremely difficult to counter 72 hours before the election, especially if there's not a phenomenal lashup between municipal governments, state governments, and the federal governments. And DHS, CISA is doing a great job, but again, they may not have the resources to cover the entire landscape. That is my concern, you know, if I had to to look around the corner in the immediate in 2024 is that disinformation campaign right before our election, our presidential election cycle.
Anything beyond 24? If we go past the election, are there things that are in the back of your mind?
Yeah, I mean, whatever. Everybody talks about the 2027 being a decision point for the PRC, whether or not they you know execute action across Taiwan Straits scenario. I'm not 100% convinced that is the case, but if that does happen, we are going to be given a decision, and you know it could be predicated or preceded by attacks by the. By the PRC on our critical infrastructure, on the critical infrastructure in Taipei, or our other allies in East Asia, the Japanese or whatnot. And then, you know, those are the technical threats. Then we're going to be given a choice. Do we intervene? Do we counter? And I'm not 100% convinced that we have the political will at this point in the United States to make that decision. And I do think we as a country have to, and these debates are happening in Congress currently about our support to Ukraine. I think as a country we have to start having a dialogue as to what is critical for our future as a country. Are we a leader in East Asia, and will we make the hard choices when they're presented to us? If they're presented to us, and I'm not convinced that they will be in 2027, but if they are presented to us, what choices are we going to make as a country? Because we could make one choice, which would be very difficult for us and could involve war with the PRC. But if we make a different choice, the United States may be basically deciding that we are no longer a power in East Asia. And those are some very profound choices in my mind. And I'm concerned that we're not having that dialogue as Americans currently.
Andy, thanks. Great discussion. Sobering, but hopeful in places. So thanks.
It's always good to be hopeful, but you know, you have to sprinkle in some doom
course,
and gloom there, or else we wouldn't be former CIA officers.
Of course, we wouldn't be. Yeah, that's right. Andy, thanks again for being on the podcast.
Thank you, Andy. It was a pleasure.
That was Andy Boyd. I'm Andy McCreadis. Please join us next week for another episode of Intelligence Matters. And you can always reach us at intelligencematterspod@gmail.com.
Intelligence Matters is produced by Steve Dorsey with assistance from Ashley Berry and Sophia Rubin. Intelligence Matters is a production of Beacon Global Strategies.